Pittsburgh is coming up. For WGTD News, I'm David Cole. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may have be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We confront a difficult and challenging question today. That question is, what is the value of a human life? And are human lives different in value? That is one person's life worth more than another's? As it turns out, although the thought of it might be really distasteful, even morally repugnant, the fact is that we attach price tags, if you will, to human life all the time, in ways that are sometimes quite apparent and sometimes in ways that are very much hidden from view. And this is explored in a very, very interesting new book called Ultimate Price, The Value We Place on Life, published by University of California Press. The author is Howard Stephen Friedman, a data scientist, health economist and writer who teaches at Columbia University. And he explores this really important question from a number of different angles through the course of his book. And certainly, as we find our way through the COVID-19 crisis, there are ways in which some of the questions that he raises in his book are particularly timely. Again, the title of the book, Ultimate Price, The Value We Place on Life. Howard Stephen Friedman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
I'm glad that we can have this conversation. How much has this been a point of interest to you? I suspect that because of some of what your professional life has entailed, you have probably had to kind of wrestle with some of these questions for quite some time.
It's true. I've wrestled with it professionally for decades, and I've seen it in different perspectives. I've seen it through the perspective of for-profit companies and, you know, their viewpoint, which is very important, but it's a very different viewpoint and set of analytics than what happens in the public sector, for example, like a regulatory agency, who has a different perspective and does a very different calculation. So I've seen them from these different perspectives. But for me, a lot of it really got initiated following September 11th. I'm a native New Yorker, and I was living in D.C. at the time. And I can flesh that out for you a bit more if you're interested.
Of course. And I think what you're going to be doing is exploring the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund that ultimately was created, but which also stirred up a great deal of controversy on top, of course, of the monumental amount of pain that was part of 9/11. Tell us what we're talking about here.
That's exactly right. You see where I'm headed. So, but it really was a trigger point for me because following September 11th, a victims' compensation fund was created. It used taxpayer money, and the idea was to have a fund which would pay the families of the victims a certain amount of money, and they would agree to not file lawsuits. The fund was administered by Kenneth Feinberg, and he was given some instructions. He was given some constraints that he had to take economic impact into consideration, which is similar to what civil courts do. Well, he created a formula. He put a minimum value of life. He said no matter who you are, the payment must be at least $250,000. And he capped it at the top. He said no matter what you were earning, he wasn't going to assume that you were earning millions, but he capped it at a little over $200,000 per year. The net result was that there were a large range of the payments made to the families of the victims, the highest being over $7 million, the lowest being about $250,000. That is 30 times more. And the difference, what drove this huge difference, was mostly income. Now, a lot of people were very offended by the idea that some families would get paid 30 times more than others. They felt it was unfair. And Feinberg himself later said that had he had the opportunity to do it again, he would have simply paid the same amount to all families. He said it would have been easier to administer, less controversial, and more accepted by the public. And he, you know, has been an administrator of many different funds and has had the chance to do this other times. And in fact, following the Boston Marathon bombing, that's exactly what he did. Private money was raised, and in that fund, he allocated the same amount to the families of the victims who died in the Boston Marathon bombing, regardless of what their income was, regardless of the number of dependents, regardless of any other factor that could have been considered.
I have to confess that as I began reading this portion of your book, I was not immediately seized by a sense of outrage. As I first began reading about this very complex sort of web of factors that that Mr. Feinberg had assembled in order to try to come up with some kind of fair way of calculating such a thing, it didn't immediately strike me as something terrible. And I think maybe partly because it was so complicated, it seemed like an earnest, well-meaning attempt to try to answer what is in some respects kind of an unanswerable question. How do you calculate the value of a human life, especially in monetary terms? And it's only the longer I read it and started to reflect on it that I started to realize that there was something almost horrifying about it. I wonder if other people...
I want to, supplement on your point there. I think he's a very moral person who did his best given constraints. And a lot of people say that maybe, a lot of people say the fund should not have existed at all. After all, there have been other terrorist attacks and no government funds were created. There'll be other murders, deaths, government funds are created. But I think that he did his best given the constraints. But what he opened the door on was this idea of the fact that in many of our court systems, there is no minimum value of life. He asserted that, and he capped the top. Had he not done that, the truth is the range would have been much, much higher because you have some people who are earning hundreds of millions of dollars, and some of the people who died were certainly earning millions a year. Had he not capped it, he would have come out with a range of $250,000 to clearly more than $20, $30 million, and it would have seemed even more egregious, that huge disparity in life.
Absolutely, absolutely. So tell us then how it happens that he oversaw dispersal of funds after the Boston Marathon bombing, and as you've already said, did so in a completely different way. Was it because the two situations were different or the constraints were different, or because he had come to, in a sense, a change of heart?
Yeah, it's like you mentioned, I teach at Columbia. I believe you just asked a question where the correct answer is all of the above. He himself had a change of heart, and he was very sharply critical of the formula he developed, even just a couple of years after the September 11th compensation fund had been established. So he was critical of it himself, but also there are some differences. The Boston Marathon bombing was private money. There were no constraints placed on him. They simply said, we trust you. He's been a special administrator of many of these disaster funds, and people trust him. He's a moral person who certainly is aware of the sensitivities, and I think he takes this deeply into consideration. So they trusted him, and he went through a process doing what he felt was morally right. and what would be most acceptable. And he came up with this implementation where all lives were valued equally, which is actually the same approach that our regulatory agencies take today. So, you know, we can talk a little bit about past inequities amongst regulatory agencies, but today, whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency or Highway and Transportation Safety Administration, Food and Drug Administration, each one of those assumes that all lives are valued equally, regardless of age or where you live or your income. So he went with that approach of all lives are valued equally.
In the same chapter, you cite a couple of different moments from relatively recent history. One of them, back in 1988, actually involved reparations paid to Japanese Americans who had been interned during the Second World War. And you draw a contrast between that and something that occurred a few years later in a government study called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which ended up stirring quite a bit of controversy. Contrast these two things for us, please.
Well, they are quite different. So the reparations for the victims of the internment, this is an event. It happened, past tense. Real people who the quality of their life was dramatically impacted, violations of our constitutional rights and human rights were implemented. And this was a small amount to at least acknowledge guilt and recognize that inappropriate action was taken. So it's quite different from, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel that's simulation work that's
right.
Projecting forward where they had assumed different values of life. And I think it's probably a better analogy to think about that internment situation and the payments for those who are wrongly imprisoned. Because once again, you know, working not off a simulation and projections forward, but payments for past injustices. And when we look at this payments for wrongful imprisonment, there's a tremendous range. Some states cap it. Some states say no matter how long you've been in prison, you cannot be compensated for more than an amount of a few hundred thousand dollars. Meanwhile, high-profile cases, such as false imprisonments against police in New York, that resulted in a settlement of multi-millions of dollars. So you have huge disparities across the United States, and here's where you see state-dependent laws really have a dramatic impact on compensation for, in this case, I guess the best frame we could call it is quality of life, because we're not talking about death, but we're talking about really constraining someone's quality of life and impacting their civil rights and human rights.
I guess that really underscores the fact that this plays out in a lot of different ways, in many different arenas. And what at the outset is a complicated enough challenge, if it were limited to one arena, becomes still more complicated in terms of us grasping it when it plays out in so many and in such varied fashion.
Absolutely. And the way you framed it is very helpful, because what I describe in the book is that the purpose, the perspective of how you value life impacts the calculations, the inputs, the considerations you take. It's not that there's one simple formula, but rather the formula depends on what your purpose is and your perspective.
By the way, in this chapter, you spell out several different ways in which this kind of calculation for the value of a statistical life can be drawn. And you call the logic of each of these methods into question. Can you just sketch a little of this for our listeners?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the application. The value of a statistical life, it's a measure that economists have developed. It's meant to reflect how much money people require to take on more risk. That's its purpose. It's used by regulatory agencies as a bit of a proxy for what is the value of life itself. So regulatory agencies, when they try to figure out whether a new regulation is cost beneficial, will use the benefit of lives saved where they monetize it. They put a dollar figure on it, using this value of statistical life, which these days is roughly about $10 million. So that's the purpose. As for how it's derived, I'm pretty critical of it in the book, because each method is flawed. And let me describe some methods. One method looks at the hazard premium. So if you take on a job that's riskier, you have more chance of dying in the job, then economists look to see how much more an employee gets paid. So if you get paid a certain amount more for an increased amount of risk, then that might suggest what is your amount of money needed, what is your value of statistical life. The flaw in that is very straightforward. First, most employees don't know what the incremental risk of their job is. Also, many of them don't have negotiating capacity. So they're making a fairly uninformed choice that they don't have control over, but the data is used anyway. Other approaches, ask surveys. So just really walking around and asking people, how much more money would it require you to take a 1 in 10,000 risk of dying in the next year or something to that effect? And those are theoretical questions. No one really understands what they mean. They get a lot of answers that aren't useful, such as I can't tell you or infinity, and they drop the answers that they feel aren't useful, and they hold on to the answers that they think are. It's so flawed. Theoretical questions to a non-random population, and then discard the answers that you can't use, and then come up with a number. So I could criticize the metric easily, but I think it's useful to focus on the value of it. It's a large number, a number that's meant to balance safety with benefits. And in being a large number, like I said, about $10 million, it has the huge advantage of protecting lives. And being a value that is the same for all people, it serves to not isolate people. What I mean by that is lives that are less valued are less protected, and lives that are more valued are more protected. So if that number was low, it would tell industries that they don't have to invest a lot in safety. As the number was low for one segment of the population and much higher than others, then the less safe devices would be targeted to the population who's valued less.
So it's a matter not only of the calculation itself, but also how that calculation or the results of that calculation are interpreted and or applied.
Absolutely, and you've framed it perfectly. In the book, what I try to describe is, while there are certainly plenty of limitations in the calculation, the application does serve a public benefit, a public good. If you go back to the 70s, regulators were deriving this benefit based on lost earnings. But lost earnings have lots of biases to them. There's gender biases, racial biases, age biases, location biases. So deriving off of income is problematic. Many people choose to be caregivers, and so they would have less income, and as a result, their lives would be valued less. So moving from this highly biased estimates to a single number that's much, much higher is a benefit, even though the methods that used to derive it can all be criticized easily.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard Stephen Friedman about his brand new book, Ultimate Price: The Value We Place on Life. This is a book that explores this question as it plays out in all kinds of different ways. And he says early in the book, how we arrive at a price tag on life says a great deal about our priorities. These price tags are markers of what we define as just, infused with influences from economics, ethics, religion, human rights, and law. Our values as a society are reflected in both the methods used to develop these price tags and the prices themselves. One of the things that you mention in kind of talking about the kind of the overall framework of such price tags is that in many, many respects, not only does this happen all of the time, with significant ramifications for our lives, but that in many cases, these price tags are often neither transparent nor fair. And maybe you could just for a moment explain some of the ways in which this kind of creation of price tags on human life is done in ways that are not transparent. That might seem like it goes without saying, but I suspect that that's true in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. And two whole areas where it's not transparent but critical are in our civil court system, where when you look at negligent death cases, often they're settled. They're not in the public domain, so you can't see what the value was assigned. And we can talk about the unfairness in a second, but back to the non-transparency, corporations continuously do this type of analysis. They do financial calculations to estimate what are the costs of them improving the safety of their products, and a trade-off in terms of the value of the lives saved. Now, that value comes from the company's perspective. And from the company's perspective, they're concerned about losses due to lawsuits, regulatory fines, as well as damage to their brand. There's a lot of great examples, most recently with car companies, and they date back to the famous 1970s Ford Pinto case to even just the cases of the last few years, Volkswagen and Toyota. And each one of those, the car company had a choice. They had a decision they could make that was a trade-off of safety in terms of saving human lives and also the expenses involved. In the example most recently of the Toyota acceleration case, the company was well aware of issues with the acceleration system. They chose not to make the repairs. In the United States, it caused less than 100 deaths. But the settlement came out to tens of millions of dollars per victim between the regulatory fines and the civil court settlements. Tens of millions of dollars. Now, you can contrast that with settlements of other corporate cases of negligence that have happened over the years. But in the case of the car companies, the Ford Pinto case, they had their cost-benefit calculation came into the public domain, the one they submitted to the regulatory agencies. And in that one, back in the 1970s, they valued human life at about $200,000. That was the cost that they had used, which is substantially lower than what regulatory agencies use today. And that Toyota acceleration case, by being settled for over $10 million per victim, sends a message to car companies that when they do that calculation, they need to insert a value of $10 million or more. By using that high number, they're much more likely to make safer cars than to ignore a known safety issue.
Let's probe into a couple of other arenas in which this question of the value of life plays out. And you've already touched on the court system and the way in which this matter of valuing a given life, how it plays out in criminal courts versus the civil justice system. This is in your chapter called Justice is Not Blind. I thought one of the most intriguing moments in this chapter is when you talked about a case that was Thurston versus the state of New York, which involved a woman, at least in this case, known as Cheryl, who dies under very sad circumstances in an institution, and the way that things played out ultimately was in a way that was horrifyingly unfair, and even the judge presiding over the case, I mean, said as much. Explain to our listeners about this this really intriguing case, because I think it speaks to a lot of the complicated issues that are at play here.
Absolutely. So Cheryl Thurston was in a care facility, severely disabled. She was supposed to be attended whenever she's taking a bath. She was left alone, and she slipped into a coma. She was unconscious for about a day and then died. The care facility was clearly negligent. Her sister sued, and they determined in court that the care facility was negligent, but the settlement was for $0. And the judge explained that the settlement was for $0 because New York state law had no number, no value that was for the intrinsic human life itself. Cheryl had been costing money. She wasn't earning a salary. And she never woke up when she slipped into the coma, so they couldn't determine that she had been suffering pain. The judge was mortified by this conclusion and described that had Cheryl been chattel, a cow or a chicken, then her sister would have been entitled to some compensation. Now, this horrifying conclusion that you can cause the negligent death of someone and yet not be responsible for any financial compensation sent a message, too, to any care facility that if you are negligent, you might not have to pay. I mention this theme a lot in my book, the idea that lives that are less valued are less protected, and lives that are more valued are more protected. In this case, by determining that her death was worth nothing, care facilities in New York certainly must have understood this message, and that tells them they don't have to invest as much in safety. Of course, there are regulations that they need to comply on, but it tells them a message, at least financially. Now, let's fast forward to today. In New York, nursing homes and care facilities have lawsuit protection for negligence that results in COVID-related infections and deaths. So if you have a relative who was in a care facility, unfortunately, they got infected with the COVID-19 virus and died, you will not be able to sue.
What I find interesting about the case we were talking about, Cheryl Thurston, is the fact that I think if you sat anybody down who had any hand in the crafting of those regulations, I would think at least that in most cases at least, this came about not with any intent to dehumanize and devalue someone's life to this extent. It feels like something that came about in a sense more inadvertently. Or am I being naive here? And are there more sinister intentions at play?
I can't say for certain, right? I can't say because I don't know the history of this particular legislation or the lack of legislation, that is the lack of intrinsic value of human life. But I think it's worth at least us recognizing that in some cases there is just simply an accidental omission. You know, that's negligence on the part of a lawmaker, loopholes that exist because they haven't anticipated. And that happens, and maybe that's what happened in this situation. Whereas in other cases, there's direct lobbying impact. Now, in this case, this is an omission, that is, there's no law there. So I hope that this is more a situation of a lack of awareness. But here we are. This is the end of May 2020. It's been more than 7 years since this highly publicized event. But everything I said is still true. So I guess we'll have to let our listeners draw a conclusion on whether this is really a lack of awareness or is this on purpose.
Right. You do say at some point in this chapter about drawing attention to America's systematic devaluing of certain lives. And I think that makes it pretty clear that that devaluation is going on, probably in many cases intentionally and sometimes maybe without malicious intent. But nevertheless, the fact that this is systematic is what really makes it scary.
Absolutely. And to your point, it's worth identifying, you know, what was the intent. But I'm very much someone who focuses on the outcome, the result. If the intention was good but it had a bad result, it's still a problem. And so certainly throughout this book and my previous book, Measure of a Nation, I discuss a lot of the inequalities in the United States and their ramifications. And in this particular book, it comes up a lot in how lives are valued. I mentioned earlier on that regulatory agencies value all lives the same. Well, they do that today, but they tested the waters. The Environmental Protection Agency during the Bush 43 administration proposed a lower value of life for older citizens and a higher value for younger citizens. Well, the public was livid. They termed this the senior death discount, and they reacted. Well, the regulatory agency backed off on that proposal. They reverted to the principle that all lives are valued equally, and that's how they continue today. My message in that particular historical note is the fact that when the public identifies an inequality or an injustice, an inequity, they should react. They should speak up for themselves, and often they can change the systems. They can often impact. I don't like people to think that this is something for technocrats. And in fact, my book is meant for a lay audience to understand how these valuations happen, but also to encourage people to take the time to understand them and, when situations are unfair, to respond, to be engaged. Otherwise, you leave yourself, your loved ones, your family, and others often less protected.
We're speaking with Howard Stephen Friedman, a data scientist, health economist, and writer who teaches at Columbia University. We are talking about his most recent book, which is called Ultimate Price: The Value We Place on Life. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Absolutely.
In the chapter called A Little More Arsenic in Your Water, you talk about probably one of the most disturbing ways in which this plays out to the detriment of certain people's lives, and that is when it comes to something like EPA regulations and various industries doing cost-benefit analyses. This is where it probably becomes this whole matter of monetizing a human life becomes especially sort of distasteful. I'm especially interested to hear from you how you see this changing, if you have seen it change at all, in terms of tilting in a direction towards more justice versus less justice.
Well, you have some inconsistencies, right? Your regulatory agencies they have their constraints, and they are required to have a cost-benefit analysis that shows that their new regulations are not detrimental to industries, right? So that the value of the lives saved, you know, has to exceed the costs of the new regulatory impacts. And, you know, some people think that's perhaps a bit too extreme, but that exists. But from the point of view of the for-profit sector, I think there's always going to be this balance. The truth is that no company can invest in every single safety mechanism for every situation and stay in business. You would have a product that's just too expensive. It's not competitive with other products. But there are regulations that provide guidance on what is the minimum standards, and then companies have to make a decision. The court system and regulators, they send a message. And so, you know, in that recent example I mentioned about the Toyota acceleration case, by having a settlement of over $10 million per victim, that sends a message to every other car company. When you do this calculation, put at least $10 million into your equation. That's a big number. But by putting that big number in, that's going to encourage them to make far safer vehicles. So that's a good thing. There's a wonderful book by Steven Pinker, came out, gosh, must be about 6-7 years ago at least now, called Better Angels.
Yes, I interviewed him about that book, actually. It's a fascinating book.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating book, and he's a great scientist and great writer. In it, what he shows is systematically, it's not just that violent deaths are down, but accidental deaths are down too. And I think a lot of that is, as the value of a human life is assessed to be worth more and more, what you see is regulators have values of statistical life that are going up often faster than things like the cost of living, so it's accelerating. And you're seeing that companies are having to put in substantially higher numbers. When the Ford memo came out in the early 70s, that $200,000 that they used, that actually came from their regulatory agency. They didn't get it from nowhere. They took it from the regulatory agency themselves. But the current number of $10 million is vastly, vastly higher than what you would get if you just adjusted for inflation or cost of living. So we are seeing greater protections on average, but slips happen. You know, whether it's Flint, Michigan, or any of the other examples where either a municipality or a regulatory agency basically underserved their population and resulted in increased risks of either sickness or death.
I want to be sure to take a moment to talk about the sixth chapter of your book, which is titled I Want to Die the Way Grandpa Died, which, among other things, explores the whole realm of life insurance. I think this is where I found some of the biggest surprises in your book, because in some ways it feels like, well, if nothing else, when we get to the matter of life insurance, things start to get a little bit clearer, or maybe cleaner. There's this idea, you plunk down money, you get a life insurance policy, and when you die, you get paid. And it is more driven by the choices that you make versus the choices that somebody else is, in a sense, making behind closed doors or out of your own direct control. And of course, the picture you paint is far more complicated than that. And that, in fact, this is not a clean, clear, and not always fair arena at all. Explain to our listeners what they will find when they explore this chapter.
Well, first, I would say that it's cleaner in the sense that this is the time where you get to put the price tag on your own life versus someone else, versus an economist, a financial analyst, or a regulator. It's you doing this. And there are ways to go about doing the calculation. You could look at what is the replacement need of your dependents. How much money do they need to live without your income? You can look at things like what is their expected lifestyle, and you could calculate that. So there are calculations that can be done. But more practically speaking, most people look at what is the monthly premium or the annual premium and look to see if there's a total value of the life insurance that feels about right. So few people do the calculations, but they can be done. That describes the process. And there's an open market, right? You get to look at different companies' quotes and decide what works best for you. Hopefully you get a good product. All that said, there are certainly some examples of inequalities. In at least one state, the life insurance companies are not allowed to consider sex in their pricing. What that means is, because women on average live 5, 6, 7 years longer than men, that in that state, women are subsidizing the men because they're getting charged the same amount even though their life expectancy is longer. States have not generally blocked the use of race in life insurance, but life insurance companies in general do not use that as a criteria, at least starting in the 50s and 60s when the life tables were getting clearer of the discrepancies, and there are substantial discrepancies in life expectancy as a function of race, but they're generally not using that. But they are using lots of other information which we may find counterintuitive. Doing surveys about your hobbies and understanding that you happen to like bungee jumping and paragliding and other things that are risky, well, that's going to likely cause your insurance to go up because they're ultimately making a calculation. What are the chances that you're going to die as a function of time? How much money you're going to pay in premiums? And what profit margin do they need on your particular life insurance policy?
I want to spend our remaining minutes talking about the seventh chapter of your book, which is titled To Be Young Again, in which you explore some of the ways in which a human life is given a price tag when it comes to matters of human health and health care. And of course, we are talking about this difficult issue and question in the midst of a pandemic. And we have all seen situations in which healthcare providers are being, in a sense, forced to make terrible choices that would seem to, at least in part, involve assigning varying degrees of value to various human lives. I wonder first, on maybe almost more of kind of a personal level, what it has been like for you to kind of see all of this play out on a global stage. I suspect that you have watched it not only, you know, just on a kind of a personal level, but surely on a professional level as well. This has been really fascinating for you to see play out.
Yeah, it's painful. You know, on a personal level, I live in New York, the global epicenter of the pandemic. And I have family in Taiwan, and we were there in January. Taiwan has never shut down. It's a country of 24 million people that has had six deaths. Six. They manage the situation. And if you look, there are many countries that manage the situation very well, aggressively. Whether it's Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Japan. And so they have minimal deaths, different levels of economic impact, but they've addressed the situation much better. And I think about the concept of preventable deaths. That's kind of the perspective I look at. And there are so many countries, whether it's kind of a Western Europe or North America, who could have prevented so many of these deaths by more aggressive policies earlier on, testing, contact tracing, those types of things, quarantining. So from a public policy perspective as well as from a personal perspective, it's very troubling. And it's not just from the perspective of looking at the inequalities and knowing who is suffering the most, who's at most risk, who's getting hit most economically, but just the reality that much of this could have been prevented with better public policies and better public health policies. To be clear, that globally, many countries just simply didn't apply. There were lessons learned, and I'm a big believer in learning best practices. And there are countries that have been through these types of experiences before, whether it's SARS or H1 or other situations, and you know, we should always be willing to learn from others. That's just a fundamental principle I have.
One of the points you raise in this really interesting chapter is that we are, in this chapter, called to place a price tag on health, which is a very similar challenge to placing a price tag on life itself. What is the value in kind of differentiating between those two, or is it even possible to differentiate between those two in a way that is helpful?
Well, there are ways to distinguish because, as I described earlier, there is life itself, and then there is the quality of the life. And you know, it came up in earlier in our discussion, but when we talk about health, the important consideration to me is the metric you choose will influence what your decisions are. If your goal is to save the most lives while spending the least amount of money, that's different from saving the most life years while spending the least amount of money, or saving the most quality-adjusted life years. That's a metric that exists while spending the least amount of money. So these different metrics, and they're choices are made. Different governments make different choices about which ones to use. They do play a role in which intervention do I fund or not fund, which procedure do I support, which life do I choose to try saving. So they do play a factor.
Yes, I saw terminology here that I actually never seen before. You say health economists use cost-utility metrics such as cost per life saved, cost per life year saved, cost per quality-adjusted life year, or cost per disability-adjusted life year. Counting life years is simple and transparent. But when we get into these other levels, then of course we're talking about many more levels of complexity.
There are, and these are controversial concepts. I'm in the book. I do take some time to criticize them, because the quality-adjusted life year, basically, it says that a life of full health and mobility is not as high as a life with substantial, you know, physical disabilities, for example. I challenge a lot of that, because not everyone accepts those notions. These are survey-based, data-based, but that doesn't mean they're universal truths. So that said, that these are metrics that are used regularly. For example, the United Kingdom, in their NICE evaluations, looks at the impacts on cost-effectiveness per quality-adjusted life year. This is part of their calculations. They have other metrics they use as well, but some governments use these metrics. So to be aware of them is important, to know their limitations, and just to understand that despite having limitations, they're out there and they impact decisions made about who gets care and who doesn't.
Right. And of course, many of these kind of discussions in terms of constructing these metrics and applying them, these are discussions that happen very much behind closed doors, very much out of the public eye.
The discussions do. The recommendations usually are in the public eye and open for comment. So, for example, provisions in the Affordable Care Act to not consider life expectancy when allocating resources. It's in the public domain. You can see it. So the discussions definitely, a lot of the technical discussions happen in the private, but they open the conversation for public comment. And that's when activist groups, non-governmental organizations need to play their role, because they usually will have scientists as their staff members to help translate this into real-world action.
Well, we can explore all of this and still more in your endlessly fascinating book, which is again titled Ultimate Price, The Value We Place on Life, published by University of California Press. And the author, Howard Stephen Friedman. Howard Stephen Friedman, I so appreciate you taking time from your schedule to have this extensive conversation about your fascinating book. Thank you so much. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. It was a privilege to be on. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Anderson Bauer, author of Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. This fascinating book explores the lives of our current ex-presidents, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and George H.W. Bush, who, of course, passed away not too long ago. This book examines how each of them have lived out their ex-presidencies, and also some of the surprising friendships that have sprung up, often across party lines. The book also explores President Trump's rather tumultuous relationship with the ex-presidents. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Wednesday, at the moment, we're tentatively scheduled to air a conversation with someone who has been contending with COVID-19. We might possibly be postponing that for another time. On Thursday, I'm scheduled with Dr. Thomas Carr, head of the paleontology program at Carthage College. On Friday, I'll be offering up interviews with several area restaurant and bar owners and operators to talk about how they have been contending with COVID-19. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. A reminder as well that The Morning Show is available as a podcast 7 days a week. And this past weekend included a conversation from way back in 2002 with Tom Kircher, author of a delightful book called Cracked Side.